So tonight, we're in the Gospel of Mark. Now, I don't know if you've sat and read through the Gospel of Mark, maybe chapter by chapter, but it's very clear from the first chapter, it's almost like this action-packed roller coaster from scene to scene. Immediately, there's a word constantly used. And it's like the disciples join the ride. They're witnessing Christ do all these amazing things, teaching these amazing things. And great crowds are obviously drawn because the things that Christ were doing, no one's seen before. But Mark chapter 8 is a very significant chapter in this gospel because it's almost like a pause. It's like there's a pause in the action. And it's almost like something has to be addressed before anything else can happen. There's a pause. And I'm going to call it a reality check. That's what I think goes on in this chapter. A reality check for both the disciples, but also the crowds, because Jesus calls the crowds to come and hear this as well, partway through. Jesus needs to teach something very important, and these are very hard truths, and they should be received as that by us tonight. No matter how familiar we are with Jesus and his gospel, these truths need to hit with a force. I really do believe that. So I hope it's not just a familiar thing where we leave and I know all this stuff. In fact, it's so strong that for the disciples who first heard it, I think it's one of the most amazing chapters of the boldness of Peter, where he declares Jesus as the Christ, the one. And a few sentences on, he's rebuking, he's saying, hey, you stop that, to the one he just called Christ. That shows the force of what's been said here. It affects Peter so much that he responds in that way. And so tonight, let's pause with the disciples and Jesus and this crowd, and let's try and see what's been said. So the first thing, the first reality check, if you want to say that, is who Jesus really is. I think it's almost for the disciples in a sense of, do they really know who they're following? I think that's the force of it for the disciples. I think the lesson begins way back at the beginning of our reading. So we're going to land a bit towards the end of Mark 8, but all the way back in, say, verse 17, I think the lesson kind of starts there. They're on a boat, they're talking about the fact they've got no bread, and they're worrying. And Jesus says, verse 17, why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive or understand? He goes on to say, having eyes, do you not see? So there's a little clue. They're not seeing something. Then we get to this blind man, verse 22, immediately after. Okay, you've seen the link, seeing, they're not seeing, blind man. And Jesus heals this blind man, and it's an unusual miracle. Now, you might have thought it's unusual because there's spit on his eyes. That's quite unusual. But actually, the unusual bit is that he does it in two stages. Jesus could have healed this man in one go with a word. We know that from many other times that he healed people. But this man, it's almost like he does half the job. And then he says, do you see anything? I see people as trees walking. It touches him again, and then he sees clearly. You're thinking, okay, there's a lesson here. Jesus has done it this way for a reason. And you're linking it back to what he just said to the disciples, and you're making the connection. Okay, so maybe the disciples, they see, yes, stage one of the healing, but they might not see clearly. What is it that they don't see? Well, we get to verse 27. Very next verse after this healing incident. And Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, he asked his disciples, who do people say that I am? So the seeing issue is to do with the identity of Jesus. And he starts broad. Who do people say that I am? They say, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, others one of the prophets. Essentially, most people don't see anything. If we're thinking about this seeing thing, people are blind. They don't see Jesus. Just, I think he's John the Baptist, maybe Elijah, maybe one of the prophets. They're not seeing. Many people today, we could list so many things that people say about Jesus, Islam, etc., etc., etc. But then Jesus zooms in. Who do you say I am? What a question. Zooms in on the disciples. Who do you say I am? Maybe one of the most important questions you could ever be asked. Peter's answer, the Christ. I don't think we feel the force of that, but he's essentially saying to Jesus, You are the one that the world has been waiting for. God's chosen king to rule, to bless, to save us from all the enemies that we've ever been afraid of. It's a huge statement. This is a huge moment for Peter. He passes the test, you could say, with flying colors, the Christ. But what did Peter have in his mind when he said Christ? We're not told, but from other parts of the Gospels, it's very clear what he had in his mind. I think he pictured a king striding into Jerusalem, destroying the Romans, because that's their big problem, Rome, the occupying force. And he strides to the throne, and the disciples sit with him. Peter's right next to him, obviously, so Peter's got maybe the highest place. And they're all adored by everyone. And the world comes, and they're the rulers. I think Peter had something of that in his mind. Listen to what Jesus says next. Verse 31. And he began, it's a beginning of something, he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. Take this in for a minute. This is so familiar to us, but take it in. Try and imagine what they thought of this. If that's the picture they had in mind that I've just described to you, and he says this, he says, yes, I'm the Son of Man. That's huge. The Son of Man is a huge title in the Old Testament. A king who all tribes are going to bow to, and he's going to reign forever. And he says, yep, that's me. But very next words, must suffer many things. What's he talking about here? We know. The cross, spat on, mocked, beaten, crown of thorns pressed upon his head, nailed to a cross. The Son of Man, the same person. Then he says, and be rejected by who? By Rome? Yep, we would have expected that. Rome, yep, because he's their enemy, they're his enemies. But no, the chief priests, the elders, the scribes, the Jews, God's people, they're going to reject him. The people we look up to, the people that has the scriptures and explains the scripture, them? Can you imagine the disciples minded? They're thinking, no way. Then he carries on, and be killed. The one who will reign forever, we read in the Old Testament, will be killed. And then he says this bit, as almost the add-on at the end, and 3 days later, rise again. I don't even think they took that bit in. They're already shocked at the first bit. Rise again? What's he talking about? Can you imagine their faces? If you want to know how shocked they were, like I said to you, Peter rebukes him. He told off Jesus. Sometimes I wish, not that we would do the same thing, but that we would have the same shock response at this teaching of Christ's cross. How we sit week after week unmoved by this shocking statement. I sometimes wish that we would be surprised all over again. But that's a side point. The point here is that this is hard to take in. This teaching about the rejected, crucified, risen Christ is hard. Because, and hear this is where it relates to us. Just think of some of the implications of that for a minute. Just quickly, this is not exhaustive. A rejected Christ, what does that tell you? If he is God's chosen king, and he's rejected by the people who should have welcomed him, not just them, the whole world, ultimately, what does that tell you about the world in which we live? It's messed up. They don't want God. So it's an indictment on this world, and it's telling you, don't put your hope in this world. Don't think it's going to get better. They did this to Christ. So it's telling you that. A crucified Christ is telling something to you and to them. It's saying to Peter, your biggest problem isn't Rome. Your biggest problem is sin. We have so many things that we think is our top problem today. A crucified Christ tells you he came to fix sin. That's what he came for. And then think, it took death for that to be fixed. What does that tell you about our sin? How serious is it if it took the Son of Man, the Christ, to face that? So it's a confronting truth, do you see? It confronts us. And even a risen Christ confronts us because it's telling us, don't put your hopes in the now. Look to beyond death. It's the opposite of the way we think. We put all our hopes here. We think this world is where it's at. So it's a confronting truth. Has it registered with you? Have you taken to heart that your sin is your biggest problem, and the only way your sin can be dealt with is by the beloved Son of God being nailed to a cross under the wrath of God? That's how serious your sin is. We take sin so lightly and we're casual about it, but when we see that's what it took, whoa. Has any of these things resonated with you as you've looked at this crucified, rejected Christ? I didn't follow Christ until I saw something of that. I was blasé about Jesus for 23 years of my life. So reality check number one, Christians are following a rejected, crucified Christ. And do you know, I think one reason why this is so hard for them and for us is because it's immediately saying to you, you're signing on to this Christ. This same Christ who experienced that, you're following. That's what it said to the disciples. That's who you're following. And immediately you're thinking, whoa, what does this mean for me? Do you see what they're thinking? Wait a minute. If he's going there, I'm following him. So the next reality check is, reality check two, what it really means to follow Jesus. And here it gets hard. Maybe one of the hardest teachings in the New Testament. What is it to be a Christian? That's what we're dealing with here. What is it to be a Christian? What would many people say today to that? What does it mean to be a Christian? Maybe people would say, churchgoer, read the Bible. Maybe people say, wear a cross. That's what makes someone a Christian. Maybe others who are more clued up on the answer would say, it's those who repent, who turn from their sins, and put their trust in Jesus Christ. That's what makes someone a Christian. You'd be exactly right. But the disciples would add things too. They'd say, hey, yeah, but also we left everything and followed him. There's been a cost. But what Jesus is about to say to this removes every limitation we've ever thought we've had. What he's about to say here, I think you might always have in your head, I've done this much, I've given this much, I've followed him this much. This removes every boundary and shatters us to our core. Listen to what Jesus said. Calling the crowd to him with his disciples, he said to them, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Now, can we make it clear before we even get into it? Jesus says, if anyone. I really stress that because sometimes we think it's certain Christians, it's special Christians, it's apostles, it's zealous Christians, it's maybe OTT crazy zealous Christians. But Jesus says, if anyone, without any exception. So what we're looking at here is an utter requirement to anyone who wishes to follow Christ. Verse 34, we've read it. We break it down into three parts. First thing Jesus says is, let him deny himself. What does that mean? Deny is a very strong word. Interestingly, it's the same word used when Peter denied Christ. That's interesting. But it's a strong word. It's capturing as kind of disowning, like as if they don't exist. That's what Peter did, didn't he? I've never known him. So picture that, deny. But it's not simply deny sin. That would be hard. Denying sin. Deny pleasure? No. Career? No. Part of your life? No. Deny your very self. No one talks like this. No one calls for this. It goes against everything we're used to. I was trying to think how to describe this, and this is not very good, but hopefully it helps. Illustrations, I don't think, are my strong point. But I think our natural... So you picture your phone, and you've got your kind of camera setting, and you have to turn it inwards when it's on selfie mode, or it turns outwards. I think our natural default setting in life, can I put it like this, is on selfie mode all the time. By that I mean, I'm always in the central frame. I'm always in the center. No matter what happens in my life, I'm always in the frame. I can't think of anything otherwise. So by that I mean the universe revolves around me. the question I ask in everything is, how does this affect me? That's my first question. What do I want in life? That's the first question that often comes. So it's like my focus has been turned inwards. My eyes look out, but really it's like that. And that's what sin has done, by the way. This is the heart of sin. It's a self-focused life. I think Gerard captures it when he says, when you see a photo and it's a group of people and you're in it, your eye zooms in to you. How do I look here? That's all that matters. If I don't look good, chuck the photo away. Doesn't matter about how anyone else. So that kind of captures it. But I think it's also, even when we seem outward, which there is, there's love and care and selfless acts in the world, I still think self is there. So I think Jesus captures it when he talks about the Pharisees blowing a trumpet as they're going to put money in the box there. Everyone, look at me. And you get it today with YouTubers or whatever it is when they're kind of giving money to the homeless and they've got their camera. Look, I'm just giving £1,000 there. It's comical, but we do that. It's in us all. We're blowing trumpets. So Jesus is saying here, he's shattering that. And he's saying, if you're going to follow me, disown your very self. Change that setting at your core. Change it. It cannot be about you anymore. Now, this isn't saying be miserable and don't enjoy yourself. Can I say the opposite? As a Christian, I've known more joy in my life and pleasure than all those years I lived without God and did what I wanted in the world. This is not talking about a morbid, miserable life. But what it is saying is that the very question you ask now, whenever you face anything, before it would always be me, I, always. But now another question comes first. What does he want? What does he say? It changes. Maybe we can give particular examples because it's easy to keep it general. Maybe just some particular examples. This would obviously mean a no to sin. A no to, I'll give some exact examples. A no to getting drunk. A no to sleeping around. A no to porn, etc., etc. Because it's not about before, it was just what I want. Now it's no. What does the Lord say? But also it's with good things. So let's give an example of someone who always wanted to be married. And before, all they ever asked was, who do I want to marry, when, do I want to be married, etc., etc., etc. Now the question is, wait a minute, what does the Lord want? It's good, I can be married, but the whole setting of your life changes because you've denied yourself. That captures something of it. I don't think I've done a great job of trying to show you that, but at least it shows you maybe the radical nature of this. Maybe it's for discussion. You can chat about it later, what you think it means to deny self. But can I testify that as a Christian, self lurks in everything. God shows it everywhere. You stand and you think you've served the Lord and he says, hey, self was there. Do you see? So that's the first thing, is this denying of self. If you want to follow me, Jesus says, you've got to deny self. But as a second thing, maybe this gets even harder. Take up your cross, he says. Now, we must define cross, because back then, when Jesus said this, people would have known exactly what he was talking about. I'm sure lots of people witnessed crucifixions. There was many people crucified at the time of Jesus. It was a Roman way. Now, today, though, when you think of cross, what do you think? A nice gold symbol on a necklace or top of a church. I think Gerard touched on this recently when he said actually a modern version of cross would be an electric chair. So imagine someone walking around with an electric chair on their necklace. Actually, Billy Graham said that actually you could reword this to kind of try and catch how it is today. You could imagine Jesus saying, take up your electric chair and follow me. That doesn't quite capture it, but at least it gives a sense of the force of, wow, this is strong. So what we're supposed to picture here is a shamed prisoner carrying a cross to a place where they will die. And on the way, they're despised, mocked, and jeered by those watching. And Jesus says, yeah, I need to take that up, and so do you. So this surely isn't about general suffering in life, because everyone suffers, right? Sometimes people say, yeah, I'm just taking up my cross. I've got a bad relationship at the moment. No. That's not what this is about. This is about being publicly associated with Christ who himself died on a cross. Verses earlier, that's what he spoke about, didn't he? Verse 31, he speaks about his own cross before he says, take up your cross. So I think this is capturing something of this public allegiance to Jesus. And I'm going to go wherever he says and whatever it costs, even if it's death, torture, whatever it means. So maybe at this point, we have to pause maybe and ask yourself, am I willing to follow Jesus if... Where's your limit? If I lost this, maybe that's a helpful way to think about it. I don't know. But it's a strong call. It's this, come with me, whatever it means. Loss of loved ones, losing friends, all reputation, even imprisoned death, whatever. Are you willing? Are you willing? Okay, deny yourself, take up your cross. Thirdly, follow me. I think this bit is the key. Because if you only saw the first two things, all you're going to see is someone who looks like they hate themselves and they're just miserable through life and just punishing themselves, just saying no to themselves all the time and carrying a cross. And what for? Here's the answer. Follow me. We realize what's going on. They're following someone. That's where they're looking. Do you see what's happened in these three things? Self has been removed and replaced with Christ. I has been taken away, and I'm now following him. That's these three steps. Jesus has become the center of their universe now. Whatever he says they do, wherever he leads, they go. Paul puts it like this, I have been crucified with Christ. This is Paul later on in the New Testament. He got it. I've been crucified with Christ, and it is no longer I who live, self, but Christ who lives in me. He said it perfectly. And I think we can actually sum it up in one word, surrender. I think that captures it. One word, surrender. We're talking about someone who has completely surrendered to Jesus. I'm talking no limit, no yes, but not this. I've surrendered everything. We need to get our heads around this. What a reality check this is. Jesus is saying here, if you really want to come after me, this is what it means. I love this because he leaves no one in the dark. I thank God that Gerard, I've mentioned Gerard a lot tonight, but when I was seeking Christ and I wasn't yet a Christian, I remember having a conversation with Gerard. I remember it photographically somewhere over there in this church. And he said to me, as before, what did I do? Something funny. It was there. Sorry, yeah, right there. But the point is, I was chatting to Gerard, and I wasn't yet a Christian, and he brought this verse to me. And he said, if you're seeking to follow Christ, this is what he calls for. And it's almost like Gerard was pushing me away. I thought he'd be excited for, like, new converts in the church. But he's like, no, this is what it means. And it hit me like a ton of bricks. And I'm so glad he did it, because I knew what I was getting into. And I think that's what Jesus is doing here. I think it's almost a bit of a pushback. A gentle pushback saying, hey, wait a minute, followers and would-be followers. Do you really want this? This is what it's going to mean. Do you really want it? We need to get our heads around this. And we must pause, I think, because we live in a particularly comfortable Western society where everything is the complete opposite. We've spoken about this morning about this noise you hear around us. I think this is the noise. Do you live for you? Don't put yourself out. Be who you want to be. It's everywhere. Self, 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 self. And maybe then, with that in mind, this lands on your very issue tonight and mine. By the way, I was praying about this last night, and I don't feel preaching on this is hard because it's the very issue for me. Maybe this is our very issue. Maybe this is the reason why some of you are not yet Christians. You say you'd like to be. You've even maybe tried and you've prayed. But you don't want this. You don't want verse 34. Even Christians, we must ask this. In light of the words of Christ here, have we forgotten that this is what we have signed up to? This is our road. Yes, it looks different for everyone. We're not all going to be martyred and all of that, but this is still our road in some way, shape, or form. Here, I say this because are we fighting against it? Are we doing what Peter does and we try and drag Jesus here and say, no, 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 Lord, this will never happen to you? Jesus says to Peter, get behind me. He's basically saying, I'm leading. You've tried to move in front of me and tell me where to go. Get behind me. Get behind me. Is he having to say that to us? Am I trying to direct Jesus and tell him where I think my life should go? Or am I behind him, following him? Does he have to say to me and you, get behind me? You've tried to go in front. You tried to tell me how this should go. It sounds strong, but maybe this is the reason why our Christian lives are so miserable. Because I'm constantly fighting against this road. I'm trying to live two paths. I'm trying to go in this other path, and I'm supposed to be going here with Jesus. Maybe that's why Christ is distant, because I've stopped following him and I've gone off here down this other comfortable road. Of course he's going to be distant. Are we refusing to surrender? Do you know I had to have this wake-up call to me from a non-Christian? I think I've shared this before, but I was on the phone to a non-Christian who is a guy I used to work with, and we've spoken a lot about the gospel. He said to me one day, I can't remember how he said it, or something about being I can see you're a man of God, you're following God and stuff like that, but don't be surprised if the Lord takes you down. And I was like, what? It's like it hit me like a ton of bricks on the phone. I was like, what are you talking about? This is someone who isn't a Christian who sees this. He said, well, think about it. He says, if God allowed that to happen to his son, the cross, the crucifixion, is he going to spare you? The servant, if the master got that, it hit me like a ton of bricks. I suddenly remembered what this calling may lead to and what I signed up for. So these are hard truths. And surely at this point, a big question forms in the crowds at the time, the disciples, and maybe with you now. If this is true, if these two things are true, that Jesus is really this and his followers are really this, why follow him? Why follow him? Why follow this rejected Christ? Why walk this path of denying self? Why? Well, Jesus goes on to deal with that exact thing in verse 35 to 38. So let's read it. This is what he continues to say. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? Let's stop there for now. He's saying here, basically, let's play it out. Let's imagine you avoid my call to follow me. Let's imagine you avoid self-denial, taking up your cross, and instead you go the way of everyone around you. Let's imagine that. Let's imagine you seek and spend your life trying to save your life. By that, we're kind of saying this kind of attitude of I'm thinking of me, me, me. I'm protecting myself from any harm, from putting myself out. Let's imagine you do that. You seek to save your life desperately, like everyone's doing around us. Think of the advertisements. They're all built on this kind of idea of save your life. Do this, protect yourself. Da, da, da. Let's imagine that's your mantra. Jesus says, don't you see? You'll only lose it. Go to cemeteries and you'll see evidence everywhere of this. 10 out of 10 people die. There's no one who has tried to save their life and kept it. It's true. We all know that. So he's putting the logic before us. No matter how hard you fight, that's one argument. Then he continues. Verse 36, we've read a bit of it. Let's read it again. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? For what can a man give in return for his soul? He says, let's take it further. Let's imagine on this journey of rejecting me, that you were even able to gain the whole world. Let's imagine that for a minute. Let's imagine, what's the whole world? All possessions, fame, friends, fun, money, holidays, love, sex, family. All, just imagine everything. Imagine everything you've ever dreamed of and you get it. He says, even then, you'll still lose your soul. that eternal part of you that was put there by God. You cannot have both. You can never have the world and your soul. The soul is too big. And he's saying, weigh it up. The soul is infinitely more valuable than everything in this world. Why? Well, for starters, everything in this world is temporary, and even while you have it, it's empty. We know that. I think you've experienced that. And he says, the soul, your soul is eternal. The one thing in this world right now that is eternal is your soul. And you currently have your soul. He says, don't forfeit it. Don't forfeit your soul. Do you know what he's saying in verse 37? I think you can't get it back once you lose it. I think he's talking about hell. What can you give in exchange for your soul? It's too precious. Once you lose your soul, that's it. Verse 38, his final argument. For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. That's his final argument. Listen to that. He's basically saying, imagine if you refuse the way of the cross. Imagine you avoid associating with Jesus and his people. Imagine you're ashamed of him, as we sung. And imagine, by doing that, you have all the popularity in the world. Everyone loves you, adored by all. But Jesus says, what will it be when I return? What will that be to you when I return on that final day in the glory of my Father and the holy angels? Can you imagine that? Every eye seeing him, people crying out for rocks to cover them in terror. He's saying, what will the world's applause mean to you on that day? He says this, these are the hardest words of all. Of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed. Horrible thought when he says, depart from me, I never knew you, into that eternal fire. He says, weigh it up. Weigh it up. But do you hear the flip side in his argument as well? We skipped it, but verse 35, he gives the opposite. What if you do follow him? Listen to that, second part of verse 35. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. Everyone's trying to save their lives and they're going to lose it no matter what, because 10 out of 10 people die. But whoever loses their life for my sake will save it. It's guaranteed, he says. Just as it's guaranteed that you will lose it because all die, you're guaranteed to save it if you come to me because I rose. He rose from the dead. So you've got this certainty. Basically, this is the one way that saves, essentially. What will you choose? Eternal life or this? And can I add this as well? There's one sense you save your life at the end, but even now you save your life. By that I mean, I'll give one example. Before I was a Christian, I lived for this world. I really did. There was no limits on me whatsoever. I haven't shared the half of it with this church. But can I say that I was utterly miserable? And the happiest I've ever been in my life is when I've been most surrendered to Jesus Christ. We think surrender to Christ, verse 34, drudgery. But actually, when you do taste those moments of surrender, and sadly they're rare in my life, I wish I was more, but those moments when I have been and I've tasted it, Lord, here I am, I'm yours, whatever it is, here I am, I'm holding nothing back. Oh, the joy and peace that comes in those moments, there's nothing like it. So even now you find your life. Have you been convinced? Following Jesus is the only way, no matter how hard it might be. But we're not finished. If we finished here, I think there still might be a wrong picture, because so far you might have the picture. Okay, verse 34, all that hard stuff, denying self, taking up cross, following Jesus. It's kind of like this hard road, and at the end, I get my reward of heaven for all that hard work that I've done. I've denied myself, and I've said no to sin, and God says, well done, you've done well enough, get heaven now. That's not what happens here. If you, please don't leave thinking that. This is a gift paid for by Christ. He speaks about his cross, verse 31, before he speaks about your cross. He paid, he died, he's opened the way for us to enter, and we enter by faith. I hope that's clear. This is a free gift. So this is not do this, 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 and then you get this at the end. So we have to ask one more question before we close. What is it that's driving the Christian then in this hard road that we've looked at? Yes, it's a must, and there's a way in which it has to be that way, and that's another sermon for another day. But I want to look at what's the motivation for a Christian as they're walking this road. Is it to gain heaven? They've got it. They're saved by faith. What is it? Did you notice it in verse 35? For whoever would, but whoever loses his life for my sake, do you see it there? Whoever loses his life for what? For my sake. That's why they're doing all of this. They're doing it for Jesus. That's why they're denying self, saying goodbye to the world, taking up their cross, enduring torture and mocking. It's for him. They're doing it for him. They're not doing it for some sort of entry. They're doing it for him. What does that say? I think it's saying they must see something wonderful in Christ to go through all of that for him. They must love him more than anything. They must have seen something in him that has grabbed them, and they've been willing to lose everything. And I think that's the point here. Because remember where we began? We began with the blind man, disciples not seeing properly, and then Jesus says, who do you say I am? Look at me. Do you see me? Do you see the point? End on this. If you're ever going to surrender and live that life for Christ that you think is impossible, you have to first see him. And particularly verse 31, what does he zoom in on? See his cross and resurrection. If you see a glimpse of that, verse 34, the hard road would be a no-brainer. It would be obvious. He died for me. He did that for me. He, the Son of Man, the King of Glory, the Eternal One, faced mocking and spat on for me. And I've spent my life sinning against him. And he did it because he loved me, and he did it to give me eternal life as a free gift. If I saw that, if I saw his heartbeat and his love, I would say, of course I'll follow him. Of course I'll go through that. Of course I'll let go of that. I've never found anyone like this. So if there's something in seeing Christ, if you saw a glimpse, I don't think there would be any cost too great. I really don't think so. So your great need tonight is not to buckle up and try harder, and to start denying myself. Your great need tonight is to see something of his love for you on Calvary at the cross. Something of it. Even a glimpse. Maybe some of you here who are not Christians, you need to see for the first time what he has done on the cross 2,000 years ago and how it was for your sins that he was held there. Once you do, I think the only fitting response will be verse 34. Jesus says it. Let's close on this. Calling to the crowd, to him, with his disciples, he said to them, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. And my question tonight is to all of us, will you finally surrender to that call?